This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey there, welcome into this week's episode of the Show Before the Show podcast. One of my favorite podcasts, my favorite person in a lot of ways, Conan O'Brien. I love Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. And in recent weeks, they've been Matt Gourley and Sonam Obsessian, his two cohorts on the podcast, have been ripping on Conan for how weird he gets when he starts the show. And I was like, I bet Sam and Ben have wanted to do that with me for every single episode ever. When I'm like, hey there, welcome in, folks. And this week's episode. I don't know how to start podcasts. My name is Tyler Mon. I'm here with Sam Dykstra and Benjamin Hill. You would think after like 300 and how many episodes of this have we done? A lot. This is episode 312. You'd think I would have gotten some sort of formulaic open down, but nope.
Well, I mean, I honestly, when you were saying like one of my favorite podcasts, which I thought you were going to say is this podcast, but I'll move past that.
No, I don't listen to it.
One of my favorite people in the world, which I thought you were going to say was me, but no, you moved on and said the other Irish guy from Massachusetts.
Right. Just the one other one.
The one other one. Well, I'm not related to. We're not all related. But yeah, no, you just completely jumped right to Conan, which I can't
believe. I did.
His interview with Obama, who we have not had on the podcast.
We have not had on the show. Shockingly, we have had.
It's always open.
We've had zero former presidents. But, if any former pres who, is a White Sox fan wants to come on the show, I'm sure he's making the podcast rounds, it seems like. Also, there's another The Show Before the Show connection. You in the background of your shot, Samuel P. Dykstra, have Polar Park, the home of the Worcester Red Sox. That's where Conan's mom's family is from Worcester.
Yes.
So there's a connection there. And Ben, I'm sure this is all thrilling to you.
Oh, it's awesome. I love it. You know, I do like Conan O'Brien, so any Conan talk is
fantastic.
Is fine with me.
He's a successful podcast opening host. And you all are stuck with me. So we welcome you into this week's episode of The Show Before the Show, where we talk all things minor league baseball and the official podcast of minor league baseball. Tyler Mon, Sam Dykstra, Benjamin Hill. We are into another week, closer and closer to the midway point of this minor league season. As crazy as it is, we're already over a full month into the altered minor league campaign, and things have been going all right. We're seeing prospects moving all over the place. I just got back from watching Julio Rodriguez decimate international pitching over a week in Florida at the Olympic qualifiers, and he and his team are on to the final qualifier later this month. You guys, all kinds of stuff going as we continue progressing further into the season. And I feel like right out of the gate, it's a good time to just point out how delightfully smooth this season has gone so far from a minor league baseball perspective. I think there was like a lot of apprehension before the season started of like, all right, the pandemic, what if there are game reschedulings? What about vaccinations? What about capacity and all of that? I know we got a lot of ballparks that are returning or have returned to 100% capacity. Schedule wise, things have progressed pretty normally across the minor leagues. This has been pretty great. And Ben, I know you talk so often with people around the industry. Is there a sense of, I don't want to say surprise, but maybe just ultimate relief over how things have gone so far to this point?
I definitely think there's relief because it could have been a lot worse given all the uncertainty that went this season, especially after No 2020 and the lingering concerns related to the pandemic, of course. But I also feel like a lot of teams I've talked to are looking at 2021 combined as, I don't want to quite say a mulligan year, but a year to kind of get through with the new reorganization of the entire minor leagues, a lot of new relationships, ways of doing things. That combined with, just taking such a massive hit in 2020 and not being able to, have in a lot of cases full staffing and a normal budget going into 2021 and not knowing the extent that fans would come back. I think, like for a lot of us, 2021 is on a certain level a year to get through, even though it's going better than it could be. I think the real optimism is for 2022. And if we're really getting big picture, really like 2023, 2024, when, knock on wood, fingers crossed, all that kind of stuff, that we're really back to full speed 100% with how teams are operating, what their budgets are, their revenue fully established within the new setup, and just have a real sense of their long-term future. I've definitely heard people who are really optimistic about the long-term future, but 2021 is a challenge, even though it could have been way more challenging.
And along those lines, Ben, and we'll get into one of your recent pieces here in a second, but does it feel like it's even a little bit ahead of where we expected? I mean, it feels like every week we have these conversations with folks, and we'll have a couple of people from Bowling Green on later here, who say, you know, we're hitting 100% and capacity anyway. And that feels like earlier than I thought we were going to get there personally, but as somebody who knows the business of baseball, business of minor league baseball better than anybody, does it feel like we are a little bit ahead of that expectations anyways?
Yeah, you know, it varies by region. So I think teams have their own set of expectations, but big picture on the whole, yeah. I think that when you start a season belatedly on May 4th and a lot of teams by June 1st or very soon after are saying we're now having our first full capacity homestands. Like here, we're talking on June 9th, and I know the Charleston River Dogs are full capacity for the first time today. And they're filling the ballpark with fans. They're doing a literal salute to fans, like items that keep you cool. So teams are having some fun with it and getting back to full speed. And I think quicker than they could have thought, just given all the variables going into the season. But the other thing is that there's a difference between full capacity and having sellout crowds. I think a lot of people in this country are kind of desperate to get back to normal and really want to get out to the ballpark and really want to do those things. But I think when you're talking collectively, drawing the crowds that, you know, result in standing room only berm seating, 7,500, 8,500, 10,000 people at a game, is not necessarily something that teams are getting even when they can throw open the gates and say, come on in. I should study the attendance numbers and see. I think that'd be a good project right now to see once we're reached full, teams that have reached full capacity, to see where they are in relation to other seasons, and seeing the extent to which fans are comfortable with coming back now that they actually can do so.
All right, well, yeah, that would be interesting to look into, especially as the sample expands. The six-game series means it's, you know, some teams have quite a bit more home games thus far than others. But yeah, that would definitely be interesting to check in, especially as we said, as things open up a little bit more to 100%. But Ben, as I kind of teased there a little bit, you have a recent piece up on MILB.com about crooked numbers. Crooked numbers are back for anybody who used to read Ben's old columns on these. Tyler and I were talking about this beforehand, like one of our favorite stuff that you do every year. And just the fact that the minor leagues are back means you can dive into more of these. So as you were piecing this together, what were some that kind of stood out? And I guess let's start with at the low A level. With both Kannapolis and Fredericksburg getting off to rough starts in years in which they opened new stadiums.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to preface this a little bit more, crooked numbers, I think I started writing it in like 2009 as an homage to Jason Stark, who wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer when I was a kid before he went national. And I was just obsessed with his full page weekly columns in the Philadelphia Inquirer that just highlighted all the weird and wacky stuff. So once I started writing about minor league baseball, I thought, you know, I'd love to do that kind of stuff for the minor leagues. And so this column has been running for a long time. There's been years where I've done it, you know, a couple a month, really obsessively. There's been times when I've barely had the time to do it during the season because I've been on the road and whatnot, and maybe just do one or two throughout the year. It definitely has some variables, but, you know, kind of a weird start to this season. And last week I was like, hey, it's a new season. Minor league baseball is weird. What sort of oddities have happened? Let's have a crooked number. So I didn't go wild with it, but I had some fun. And Sam, as you mentioned, one of the quirkiest, in a lot of ways, maybe dispiriting or depressing starts to the season were for two low A East teams, the Kannapolis Cannonballers and the Fredericksburg Nationals, who have two of the worst records in minor league baseball. And both those teams are playing at a new ballpark. this year. So the two new teams in the Lower East, they're playing at the new ballpark, got off to horrible starts at home. And at one point in the season had a combined record of 1-27 with the Fredericksburg Nationals not even having a home win at that point. So when you think of two teams that have combined to go 1-27, a lot of those home games at their ballpark and not getting any wins at home. And every day the fans are like, we need to christen this new ballpark, and the team and the front office are saying, we need to christen this new ballpark or the win. And collectively losing 27 of 28 games, things are going a little better right now. Checking the current standings, we have Fredericksburg at 8-23. They're kind of on fire right now. And Kannapolis at 4-26. Kannapolis is still 1-12 at home. Fredericksburg is 4-14, but I believe they lost their first 11 or 12 at home. So that was just kind of a weird one to highlight, just the excitement of a new stadium. But in the Lower East with Kannapolis and Fredericksburg, the start of the season was anything but good on the on-field angle. And what can you do? You have no control over these things.
There is also a fantastic tweet and later video. Zach Beirutti, the radio voice of the Reno Aces, tweeted on May 14th, quote, Reno manager Blake Lally sets the bar for ejections in the COVID era, gets tossed and pulls his mask over his eyes while he finishes his argument with the plate umpire. Tremendous stuff. The next day, the video came out. This is really, I mean, talk about accentuating the accessories of the COVID era. If you want to say that an umpire visually has not been doing his job for the night, using the mask is pretty, that was next level performance stuff. I'm very impressed by this ejection.
Yeah, that was one I didn't really have to write much. I just let the tweets speak for themselves. But a manager getting ejected by taking off his COVID mask and putting it over his eyes and gesturing around wildly, like, you can't, like, is this how you see the world, buddy?
It was from just a very socially distanced gap away, we should say. It wasn't a terribly dangerous thing to do with the mask. He moved the mask, and at one point actually moved the mask so it was covering his eyes, his nose, and his face. So his mouth was only exposed for a moment, and he was like 10 feet away from the umpire. So just to clarify for all of you.
Yeah, just quintessential 2021 minor league baseball ejection when you use your mask as a way to troll the umpires. So I had to include that in there. I think one more I'd mention is a really unique cycle that happened on May 23rd. The Lakeland Flying Tigers were coming to bat in the top of the ninth, winning 8-7. And at that point, Gage Workman had had two hits. He tripled in the third inning and homered in the sixth. So he's coming to bat in the ninth inning with two hits. And he was only the seventh batter of the ninth inning. But he was the seventh batter of the ninth inning, and he got a single. So now he has a single, a homer, and a triple. The Flying Tigers keep scoring, and then he comes to bat as the 16th batter in the inning and hits a double to extend the lead to 20-7 to cap a 12-run inning and to get the cycle. But he got the cycle by batting as the seventh and 16th person to come to the plate in the ninth inning. So, that's one of those things, you know, when the ninth inning started, I can guarantee you hitting for the cycle is the furthest thing from Gage Workman in everyone's mind. But to come up twice, the first time when you're the seventh batter of the inning, and it is just insane. And I kind of love that stuff.
Yeah, I can't imagine that many times in baseball history a cycle has been achieved with two hits in the ninth inning. And even more so when you aren't due up for seven batters to start the ninth inning. But that's a pretty cool one. Crooked Numbers is on MILB.com right now. You can go check it out. And this week, we have a very unique interview this week. Interview segment, I should say. I was an observer for this interview. I was on for you all. But I just got to sit and listen and laugh. Ben, tee it up for us as we head to Bowling Green this week.
Yeah, Tyler got to sit when this one out, and maybe that was a good thing for him. But the Bowling Green Hot Rod staged Karen Night in honor of women named Karen, people named Karen gotten free. You know, it was a reference to, if people are online or too online, it was a reference to Karen becoming kind of an online phenomenon and as sort of a symbol of a broader tendency, if that makes sense. Anyhow, let's just talk to Bowling Green Hot Rod's Karen Night. General Manager Eric Leach of the Bowling Green Hot Rods, and perhaps a special guest as well.
This past year has shown us that without your health, you have nothing. If you're not well, you can't work, look after yourself, or take care of your family. you can't enjoy the life you've worked so hard to build. That's why you need to prioritize taking care of your long-term health today, before it goes from good to bad to worse. So invest in your long-term health with Forward. Forward is intelligent medicine with a personal touch. Their doctors are dedicated to catching top killers like cancer and heart disease early before it's too late. And catching them early could save you tens of thousands of dollars in the long run. Everyone's health history is different, which is why Forward doctors personalize a health plan with you, based on your genetics, lifestyle, and biometrics to achieve long-term results and ensure nothing gets missed. It's time to invest in a doctor that's invested in you. Go to GoForward.com today to protect your future health. That's GoForward.com. GoForward.com.
Here on the show, Before the Show podcast, Sam Dykstra and I are joined by Eric Leach, the general manager for the Bowling Green Hot Rods, to talk about a promotion that the Hot Rods did last week, last Thursday, June 3rd, Karen Night, in which all Karens got in free. And it was a bit of a riffing on a trend or a phenomenon in pop culture where Karen has been the general term for a overly assertive woman who wants to speak to the manager, I guess is perhaps the best way to put it. But Eric, we'll let you talk. Could you explain what this promotion was and how it came about?
Yeah, so we just decided to have a little bit of fun with this because a local business here actually on their social media called a customer a Karen. And it was some pretty wicked backlash. And I started thinking, how did this ever come about? Karens get a bad rap. And I don't know where the term Karen came from. And so we decided to host Karen Night, poke a little bit of fun at the syndrome of Karen, but also defending Karen, saying, you guys get a bad rap. Honestly, it should have been Kate after Kate plus eight, because she was the original Karen, I think. And so we decided all Karens get in free. We made buttons for them that said, my name is Karen, but I'm not a real Karen. And just had some cheeky fun with the whole night and promotion.
Well, like a very much like a typical minor league baseball team, you know, playing both sides of the fence, making sure you're not alienating anyone. So when you did the promotion, did Karen's...
Hi, excuse me. Speaking of being alienated, no one told me about what time any call was starting. So I had to go call Zoom manager to find out how I could join this this video chat. So yeah, I feel a little alienated, but if you would address all Karen questions to me, my name is Karen, and I would appreciate if you spell it right wherever this goes. It's C-A-R-Y-N, okay? Thank you.
Karen.
I think, Karen, the last time I saw you, you were shaking your tail feathers on the way out because your free ticket and free popcorn weren't enough.
Listen, you know what? I mean, you might be the manager, but I felt very disrespected because I'm a very loyal customer. And do you treat all customers that way? I don't know. Minor league baseball, do they treat their customers that way? Hello. I mean, I'm at every game. I cheer the loudest. I buy all the things. And I just want a little respect. That's all I'm asking for.
Well, Karen, now that you're here and making your presence known, you know, as Eric just said, you know, he was trying to celebrate Karen's as well, and they got in free. So this must have felt great to have a night in your honor.
You know, I feel like every night should be in my honor, but I guess I'll take once a year, I guess, other than my birthday or like Valentine's Day or like Mother's Day or New Year's Day, whatever. But I did appreciate getting in free. Any spelling, you know, so I was very concerned that I would not get in for free because K-A-R-E-N, whatever, but I am C-A-R-Y-N. We all got in for free. I did get a free popcorn. I really wanted a free corn dog, but that whatever. I got a free popcorn. And I did get to go to the complaint booth that we had set up to talk to our manager, Mr. Leach. I talked to the assistant manager, Kyle Wolf, and I did feel like I got a lot off my chest, but I felt like it was a fine night. Yeah, it was a great time, I guess.
Well, now I want to make it very clear that Benjamin Hill is the manager of this podcast. So please direct all your complaints to him. But Eric.
Thank you. I will. Thank you.
Yeah. That's at Ben's Biz on Twitter. Be sure to add him in all your complaints.
Oh, for sure. Yes. Because I will Don't worry. I will call him out if I don't like a tweet.
But Karen, like, how many of your fellow Karens did you meet? Was it like a family reunion in that way? Like, how many of you were there at the ballpark that night?
Let me tell you, there are a lot of Karens at the ballpark. I can't say how many numbers because everyone just came up to me. They're like, my name is Karen. My name is Karen. So we were all there. But I have to say, there was this one Karen came up to me and she was like, my name is Karen. And she literally was the saint of the earth, sweet as can be. And that's why we had a night like that night, because she needs to be recognized as how precious as she is. And I may have attitude. She did not have attitude. So I guess that whatever, you know, I had enough attitude for the both of us, but she was a sweet angel. But I met a lot of Karens, none that were as important as I was, but you know, whatever.
And Eric, as the manager who is accepting all these complaints or had the booth open, what was the experience like from your end of how many complaints were you getting personally as the manager?
You know, we got a ton of complaints, but a lot of it was in good fun. Like I had people come up and go, this popcorn is too buttery. Those types of things. I did have a few legit complaints. I had somebody tell me that we're not a real stadium because we don't serve bratwurst. And I explained to them that we used to serve bratwurst and they didn't sell. So we took them off the menu and we repeated that process a couple of times and ultimately they're no longer there. But most of the complaints were in good fun. People wanting to take pictures because I had a shirt on that said, I'm a manager, be gentle. Running special promotions on the visiting team instead of the ice cold batter of the game. It was the Karen batter of the game. So yes, they did strike out. So everybody won free Dairy Queen blizzards and just kind of ran that whole promotion throughout the evening.
So now that you've done Karen night, are there any plans to honor anyone else, any other notable names in American culture, or do the Karens really stand out and they're the ones who deserve the attention?
Yeah,
no one is as great as Karens. No one is as great as Karens. But whatever, you go, Eric. You tell them. But I don't think anyone's as important as me. But go ahead.
So no more Karen nights. But we are going to honor some cultural phenomenons. Like tomorrow night is beard night. Best beards, worst beards. We have jorts night coming in up for the wonderful jean shorts. And of course, later on this summer, we're gonna have Kentucky waterfall night. Honoring mullets, the fine thing that is awesome about our state of Kentucky. So we're going to have mullet competitions. So really Thursday night on the Dollar Beers, we're trying to have a lot of fun with the various promotions and come up with the cultural phenomenons. Karen just really seemed to hit a chord, especially on social media, and the engagements, impressions were awesome.
And Karen, I'm not sure if this is maybe the final question in the interview, but I do want to make sure you get the last word. Is there anything you want to add to what Eric said there?
Well, as much as I love Karen nights and I love everything being all about me, I do feel like I got to take a step back and be humbled. My husband has a beard, so I would like him to get recognized. He also has a mullet, so I want him to be recognized. I have a great pair of jean shorts that, yes, I'll be great. We've got a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun here. And I have a ball, and we've got a great team. But yes, I appreciate the questions. I mean, I feel like you could have asked me a whole lot more. I didn't get enough screen time because obviously I was late to this ball game, pun intended. But yes, it was a great time. We always have a good time. And if anybody has anything to say, they can come talk to me. Thank you.
Well, Karen, thank you very much for coming on. Eric, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate
it. For telling us about Karen Knight.
Thank you so much for your love and affection. Thank you.
Yeah, it seems like everyone's here. Good vibes, good energy. And, we're just here to document the most important minor league promotions of the day. And we think this is certainly one of them. And looking forward to what's coming up next. So thank you very much for being here, both of you.
Thank you. Everyone. I got to go get my hair dyed. So I got to go.
Okay. Bye, Karen. Bye, Eric.
Goodbye. See you guys. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Big thanks to the Bowling Green Hot Rods and Karen herself for joining the show today. That was something.
That was something. I mean, we knew that she was going to appear, but just to take you guys a little bit behind the curtain, here on Zoom, as many of you know, because you've gone through this same stuff that we have, you can hide your video. You can choose not to be on video. So we knew that Ashley Wilson, she is the corporate marketing manager of the Bowling Green Hot Rods, playing the role of Karen, both on our podcast and at the stadium in Bowling Green.
Award winning.
Yeah.
Or at least award contending. Award
to give to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She can get a Milby for best Karen impersonation on a minor league baseball podcast.
There we go. We can do that.
Not a whole lot of contenders, but yeah.
But yeah, she was off screen and we thought, okay, she'll chime in whenever she's ready. And then she literally just turned on her screen to start yelling at Ben.
Amazing hair. Perfect. It was all fantastic. It was all
I wanted that to, you know, I wanted something like that to happen, but the way it went down was just perfect.
It was great. And
kudos to Eric and Ashley for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was why when we signed on and I learned that they were both going to be on, I was like, wow, 5-person segment. I don't want to like overwhelm people. So I'm just going to observe and pretend like I'm a real podcast producer and I'll make notes if we need to edit or anything. But then I just got to sit and laugh, which was even better. Just even more into that.
We should have had you off mute.
Yeah, just sitting and laughing.
Just made you the laugh track. Yeah.
Oh, man. So with that, let's move into three strikes for this week's episode of the Show Before the Show podcast as we're talking some prospect movement and moving and shaking into the month of June. I don't think that's really how it is. Let's kick it off with a topic that Sam has described as pop-up prospects. So I assume that means the guys who hit the most pop-ups, Sam. Just kidding.
Yeah.
No, guys who've kind of come out of nowhere. Give us a lowdown on some prospects who have sort of cropped up that maybe you weren't expecting coming into this year.
Well, now I'm furiously Xing out all the tabs I had on batted ball data about pop-ups. So I guess we'll go in your direction.
Give us the weakest pop-up players across minor league baseball.
Yeah. No, Tyler's right. This is what I want this segment to be on because we are, as we said last week, we were a month in. Now we are about 5 weeks in to the minor league season. And is that a big enough sample to say guys are breaking out? Not quite, but guys are certainly popping up. They are coming up on our radars more than ever. And I won't say necessarily guys outside of top 30s or something like that, but these are guys who we all were aware of, but now all of a sudden are becoming must follows or even borderline top 100 prospects in a few cases. The one I want to point out first is Gabriel Moreno of the Toronto Blue Jays system. He's currently the number 7 prospects for the Blue Jays. Seen coming into this year as a promising hitter from the right side. He's 5'11", so he's not exactly a huge catcher, but he is a decent catcher, known for an above average arm, has some power, but has really taken off in pretty much all aspects of his offensive game so far here in 2021. He is only 21 years old. He will be 21 for the entire season. So going to Double A, a little young for that level. But at a time when we thought Austin Martin or Jordan Groshans was going to be the star of that Fisher Cats team, it has been Gabriel Moreno. So far through 21 games as of recording time, he's hitting 369 with a 427 OBP, a slugging percentage of 595. He's got 4 homers in those 21 games. Striking out 20 times, walking 7. So the numbers aren't quite there yet, but he's normally at the lower level, somebody who doesn't strike out a ton. Strikeout rates up a little bit this year, but the power that he is putting behind ball is incredible. And I'll point you to a highlight that the Fish Cats shared, in which if you've ever watched a game in New Hampshire, they have a hotel beyond the left field fence. When Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was coming up, there was a big deal made out of the fact that he homered to the hotel. Well, now Gabriel Moreno has done it. And I believe he's the first since Vlad Jr., at least the first Fisher Cat since Vlad Jr. to do that.
That is correct. So they tweeted the other day that he was the first.
Right. So that just kind of puts you or gives you an idea of the power he is showing off. He is not Vlad Jr. as a hitter. He's not going to be an 80 overall hit tool, but the power could be above average to plus. We'll see how that's going to come across. I know the Blue Jays were pretty high on him coming into the year, again, number 7, but now he could jump over a few of those guys. And, you know, Alejandro Kirk is injured right now. Moreno could be the catching prospect of the future and leap over Kirk for that role. So keeping a close eye on him for sure. Another one I want to point out real quick, who was once on this show, is Michael Harris of the Atlanta Braves system, Michael Harris II. Somebody who seemed tooled up. He's got a good backstory, 2019 third round pick out of Georgia, local kid, really likes the Braves. I implore you to go back and listen to our segment with him, but that was before he really blew up. And in part because the Braves took him to Altsite last year. They used him a bunch. They saw something in him, and that's coming across this year as well. He's batting 352, not walking much. He's got an OBP of 372, but the slugging percentage is certainly there at 500. He's got 3 homers, 9 stolen bases in 27 games. We already knew of him as a plus runner with a cannon for an arm in the outfield. If he's starting to put together something offensively as well, be a little bit more of a 5-tool potential player. He came into the year ranked number 10 in the Braves system, but easily by the time we do a re-rank could be in the top 5, which is saying something for that system for sure. So Michael Harris coming on strong, Gabriel Moreno. If you guys aren't following these guys already, I highly recommend it. These guys could be top 100 prospects very soon, or, you know, if they can keep this up, could be even more prominent than that by the end of the 2021 season.
Strike two this week always helps when you unmute your microphone. Usually a good thing for podcast purposes. Jackson Coar is a late, not late in terms, he's one of the latest entrants, I should say, into Major League Baseball after getting the summon to the big leagues with the Kansas City Royals organization. Jackson Coar, who was a first round pick in 2018, number 33 overall out of that absurdly talented University of Florida pitching staff, made his Major League debut. Didn't go great in his big league debut in his first start for Kansas City, going on the road at the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. 2/3 of an inning, 3 hits, 4 runs. He walked a couple, didn't strike out anybody. But the talent obviously is there. The Royals have this group of prospects that continues to make the climb. And we're actually going to talk about one of them coming up in our next topic here as well. But he's a number 4 prospect in that system. The 3rd among the top 4 who are pitchers, Daniel Lynch, the lefty, Asa Lacy, the lefty, and Coar, the right-hander, making his big league debut. Sam, obviously not a lot to take away from that first one. Kind of rough, but a lot of guys struggle in their major league debuts. Tell us about just the thought process on where he is right now and being at the major league level, the big 6'5", 200-pound righty out of the University of Florida.
Yeah, and the reason why we're talking about him is he is the number 97 overall prospect. So he is a top 100 talent, somebody who jumped into that as graduations happened, but had the potential and was showing like really, really promising stuff at AAA Omaha. I know if you watched that Kansas City start for his debut, you might not necessarily have seen it. Again, Tyler went through the line there, and I know he mixed in a couple wild pitches, which very clearly to me made it look like he was nervous, which is understandable. It's obviously not what you want. You want guys coming up when they're ready and fully integrated into the team and can take off running. But I think things can certainly smooth out for him. And the big standout for me is always going to be his changeup. Coming into the year, it got plus-plus grades, which is not something you normally see from a changeup. It fades really well. It pairs really well with his fastball. It's very difficult for both right-handers and left-handers to pick up, which was really interesting to me because coming into that start for Kansas City, lefties were only hitting 087 against him at the AAA level. That's because of the changeup. We talk about splits a lot, righties, lefties. Usually why lefties do a little bit better against right-handed pitchers is because they can pick up the breaking stuff, but they don't necessarily pick up the changeup well. So that's why we talk about it as so important for any pitcher. You need that pitcher to go against opposite side hitting. He has it. He definitely has it. The reason why he has been so dominant this year at AAA, and again, coming into that start, he had a 0.85 ERA, a 165 batting average against. He struck out 41 batters in 31 and 2/3 innings. It was dominant stuff. You could make a case he was the most successful AAA pitcher to start the year. But a reason why he was deemed major league ready was because his curveball had really taken off, and the Royals felt like that was a successful third pitch for him. The velocity has been there. I've seen him hit 98 in starts, early in starts, late in starts. So the fastball is obviously plus. The changeup, like I said, is plus plus. And if the curveball can be above average, and there was one start he had against Iowa where I believe he struck out 10, that curveball was working pretty well. He got a lot of swings and misses on that. If he can find that pitch at the top level, it's comfortably a number 3, number 4 starter. But as we saw last week, like he just needs to get the command of that stuff down. He needs to shake out the nerves and show what he did at Omaha, because the stuff is going to play. It really is. And I know the Royals have been a little bit shaky the last 2 years in terms of bringing guys up and sometimes seeing them succeed in the case of Brady Singer, sometimes not seeing them succeed in the case of Daniel Lynch. Daniel Lynch is back down at Omaha now. Chris Bubich is kind of on both sides of that. He struggled a little bit last year, then was going to open the year in the minors. Now he's back in the majors, seems to be figuring things out a little bit, but even he gave up that massive homer to Shohei Ohtani just on Tuesday night. So this Royals system right now is a perfect example of development is not linear. The pieces are certainly there. And one thing I'll point out about Jackson Kaur as well is that he is, I believe, the fourth pitcher taken in the 2018 draft. The Royals famously took five college starters at the top of their draft. They went very heavy on pitching. It was all from the college level. Singer, who I mentioned, Bubich, Lynch, now Kaur, all of those guys were four of the top five picks from the 2018 draft. The fact that they have all made their major league debuts is a credit to the Royals scouting staff. It's a credit to the development and getting those guys ready. Now they need them to stick because that is a potential rotation. There's still some things they got to figure out there, obviously, but Kaur sliding in there and getting his chance and getting his look at a time where, you know, the Royals were kind of circled as maybe a surprise team coming into the year. They've been about 500. If they're going to get over that hump and really compete in the AL Central, especially in a year in which the Twins are really down, they're going to need guys like Kaur to really come up and show what they did in the minors. So rough start here. I expect him to get a little bit more of a leash, get a few more starts like Lynch did. But trust me, the pieces are there. And I think Jackson Kaur could be an effective major league starter this season.
I like that description that they are very much the emblematic organization right now of development not being linear, because I think so many people just assume once guys get to the major leagues, oh, that's it. They're polished. They should be, you know, we're seeing it right now with Jared Kelenic as well. Was a tremendously talented young prospect who was probably going to be a very good major league player, but really has struggled so far this season. He's 21 years old. So for some of these guys, there are some things you go up, you get that experience at the major league level, then you're back down and you start to work on how you can conquer those things once you get back to the big league level. So another step in that direction for the Kansas City Royals organization as well. Final topic of this week's three strikes. Last night, we're recording this on Wednesday the 9th. Last night, there was a very strange moment in Double A Northwest Arkansas's win over Frisco. Bobby Witt Jr., the top prospect in that Royals organization, hammered what looked to be his second home run of the night, went into his trademark shuffle as he came across home plate, and then evidently missed the plate and was ruled out on appeal. He obliterated this home run. It cleared the berm in left center. It cleared a little fence out there and went on to, I wrote in the story that it was a walkway, maybe like part of a playground. I don't really know what it was. There were a bunch of kids running around. It's like a dirt area. But it was a no doubter in every sense of the word, except for the fact that Bobby Witt Jr. Was ruled not to have touched home plate. Now, he claims that he did touch home plate. Patrick Mahomes, Kansas City's football hero, the star of a Super Bowl champion a couple of years ago, he even tweeted about that play yesterday and said, am I missing something here? Of course, Patrick Mahomes, whose father was a major leaguer and a guy who probably could have been in the big leagues as a baseball player himself. There was a whole lot of gnashing of teeth on social media last night over this. I wrote the story. I will say there is not, from what I would glean, definitive evidence that Bobby Witt Jr. missed home plate, except for the fact of two things. One, home plate umpire and Frisco's catcher were both staring down the plate when Bobby Witt Jr. came across. Secondly, Bobby Witt Jr., as he crosses home plate, definitely hesitates, flinches, looks back, and tries to drag his right foot, his back foot, across the plate as he comes across doing that shuffle. Whether or not he touched the plate, we'll probably never know. Unless Frisco releases, you know, some different footage confirming things, like a Bigfoot sighting from, you know, somebody shooting on a camera phone up in the area right behind the plate. I don't know. But it brings us to our topic of conversation for today, which is, should a home run count once it just goes over the wall. If you miss all the bases, it's not as though you're like hustling to get in and you beat a throw and, oh, well, it turns out this guy missed third, so he's out on appeal. I mean, Bobby Witt Jr. hit that ball an estimated 430 feet, according to Northwest Arkansas. And because of the 2 inches maybe between his spike and the perimeter of the plate, he was ruled out. Your thoughts on this, Sam?
We're getting into unwritten rules territory.
Ooh, we are.
I know, which is the perfect reaction to that, Tyler. That's very good, because I want to approach that very cautiously, because I know we would.
Somebody get Tony La Russa out here for us.
Yeah, we'd open up a lot of doors here that I don't necessarily want to open, because I think if we say it shouldn't matter, then all of a sudden we're getting into kind of like the intentional walk scenario now, where it's just hold up four and, you know, take your base and, right, and don't go through the ceremony of throwing all four pitches, which has their reasons. I am totally fine with the way we do it now with intentional walks. Home runs, running around the bases is ceremonial. The only reason we do it is because it's fun to see these guys celebrate and go around and essentially receive their flowers in a way. And we get to play the music, and it allows us to stay in that moment for a little while. So I don't want to open up the door of it doesn't, like, we shouldn't touch all the bases. It doesn't matter. Because then all of a sudden we're just saying, like, hit it and walk back to the dugout, which is less fun. Unless you're like hitting it, running into the dugout and celebrating with all your teammates come out and celebrate with you on home plate, which I'm sure a lot of people would not want to see, especially the opposing catcher. But so I don't want to say that, but what we do kind of get into a territory here of is I want them to run around and I want nobody to care if they touch any of the bases, as long as they're not like cutting off third base entirely or, you know, just like going to third or doing
Larry Walker, the cut across the infield, although he was retreating on a flyout.
Yeah,
it was a very famous story when Larry Walker was elected the Hall of Fame.
This is going to kill me now. Who was the Mets player who hit the walk-off but didn't end up finishing rounding the bases because
right.
Was that Robin Ventura? For some reason, that's coming up in my head. Anyways, I'll think about it later. And I'm sure you're all yelling into your podcast devices of choice. But anyways, I don't want to get into that territory. But I want people to – I don't want the catcher and umpire to just be staring down. And like you, Tyler, that the way you introduced this was perfect, of hitting a 400 plus home run and it coming down to 2 inches. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's the letter of the rule. I don't think that's why it's in place. It's more, like I said, so guys don't completely cut off bases and stuff like that. But watching the video, I can't tell if he touched home. I know everybody else is trying to screenshot stuff. Like, if you can tell whether somebody touched something from a basically dirt angle.
From a ground level camera.
Yeah, then you have better eyes than I do. And I will take the suggestion of the umpire, who, again, is looking at it straight.
He was standing right on top of the play.
And one thing I'll bring up, too, that I'm sure you saw on social media, a lot of people are saying, like, oh, well, he cleaned off the plate.
Right
afterwards, so it's very clear that he touched it.
That doesn't
I'm
mean
sorry
anything.
Does you do realize you can kick dirt and not touch a thing,
and nobody's ever seen an umpire clean a plate before? Umpires clean plates all the time.
So
I did not buy that argument.
That's not evidence.
I didn't get that at all. I will say, do I have the floor now for my
my closing argument is just like, let's continue to round the bases,
but don't make a big deal,
let's not pay attention to see if the guy does or does not or misses by half an inch. That's not important.
Okay. I will say, ordinarily, I'm very much of the new school and all that. I'm going to be a curmudgeon. Yes, you have to touch all the bases. What is this? How easy is that? There's nobody throwing the ball in to try to get you. You can do the Sammy Sosa thing where you stutter step 18 times before you touch the bat. It's the easiest thing in baseball to touch the base after you hit a home run. Come on. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. Is it dumb that Bobby Witt Jr. was ruled to have tripled on a ball that he hit 430 feet? Yeah, but like, I love dumb baseball stuff. It's a fun, dumb baseball thing. And I absolutely love it. Absolutely. You have to touch all the bases and home plate.
What are the odds that Bobby Witt Jr. going forward is just going to like hop on the base?
Yeah.
And like do a pirouette or something.
Especially if he has that umpire again, I would imagine.
Or anytime this series.
Right, exactly. If he hits another one tonight, I would imagine that'll be part of it. Our night editor, Paige Schechter, to her credit, she said, I think after his first home run, she was like Nostradamus. She said, I feel like he's going to have a problem at that point, at some point with that shuffle across home plate. Maybe she said it after the second one, because he hit his first one, I think just before my shift had started for the night. But sure enough, he did. And it just like, I don't know. It's so easy. And to me, like, he knew that he, if not missed it, he knew that he barely grazed it, because you can see in the replay, he looks back, he flinches, and he tries to drag his back foot over it too. At that point, just stop and go back and tag it. Just tap the plate. You're fine. To be honest, like, I give credit to Frisco. I give credit to Frisco's catcher for being right on top of that. And also, I also give credit to Frisco's catcher and home plate umpire for not immediately doing what I would do, which is the second he goes across without touching, I would have been like, he didn't touch it! Oh, I didn't touch the plate! And then that would have alerted him to just go back and touch the plate. So I admire the poker faces as well. Bobby Witt Jr. is going to be fine. He is an unbelievably great young player. He's been fantastic over the last 2.5 weeks or so now. He'll be fine. This will be a dumb footnote that nobody remembers from his minor league.
Footnote.
But
sorry. One thing we should point out too, real quick, is I don't know if I can't remember when we started this segment, if you pointed it out, but Ke'Bryan Hayes.
Yeah.
Another top 10 overall prospect had the same issue in first base. Right. It's just funny that that happened on the same night. This is not like some crazy thing that's sweeping through baseball.
Right.
Enough of those going around right now. But I think it's just in the history of the game, funny things are going to happen. The fact that we got two on the same night is just a crazy coincidence. But I'm sure everybody's going to have something attached to their bulletin board in every clubhouse.
Make sure you touch the bases. I will say, you know, especially in a circumstance where, like, if you're trying to hustle to get an extra base, or you're going first to third, or, you know, you're trying to score from second on a shallow ball or whatever, and you get your footwork mixed up and miss a bag. We've all seen that happen, but not touching a bag on a home run or not touching the plate on a home run, like, come on. One of the most famous home runs of all time, when Mark McGwire hit his 62nd home run in 1998, he missed first and went back and touched it. And Joe Buck's call was, touch first, Mark. You're the new single season home run king. So like, it happens, but like, just go back and touch it. Absolutely, you have to touch all the bases. I'm not giving that up. The four balls and the intentional walk, like, man, whatever. But yeah, I'm not giving that up. Plus, I only got to do 3 home run trots in my entire life. So for all of you who can just, you know, flick your wrist and hit it 430 feet, you got to touch all the bags. For those of us who can never do that, you have to do it.
At least we can do that, right? And I just want to say real quick, because I did just confirm this, it was Robin Ventura.
Okay, good to know.
The grand slam single in the 99 NLCS was Robin Ventura. I feel much better about this.
That is, that is very good. It's also a similar play to one of the most famous named plays in all of baseball, which is Merkel's boner, back on September 23rd of 1908, which was a base running mistake by New York Giants rookie Fred Merkel, who missed a bag, if I remember correctly, and ended up, I think he was cutting around, but I don't remember exactly what happened with Merkel's boner, but you can go read the story on Merkel's boner. But missed a bag, was ruled out on essentially on a, oh, okay, Merkel advancing from first base when a game-winning run would have scored, saw fans coming onto the playing field and turned back to the dugout without ever touching second, and the play then resulted in him being a force out. So the game-winning run never scored, and the Giants ended up having to replay that game and lost, I believe, to the Chicago Cubs. Anyway, you can go read on it. It's a very fascinating story, and poor Fred Merkel never lived that down.
That actually happened in the minors a couple of years ago.
Yeah, too. Right, exactly.
Great Lakes had that happen against Lansing.
Did I write that story? I feel like maybe I wrote that story.
No, Jake Siner wrote that story.
Oh, Jake Siner. RIP, Jake.
Loons good win money. In Merkel-esque fashion.
Now with the Associated Press.
That MILB.com story. Yeah, it was Santiago Nesi had watched his teammate hit a ball, I think, to center field. Noticed that his teammate was going to score from third and immediately turned to the dugout and celebrated with his teammates, forgetting that he had to step on second.
Very strange. That was, actually the year before I started with MILB.com, looking back on it now, July 1st, 2013. So poor Fred Merkel, whose Wikipedia page lists him as Carl Frederick Rudolph Merkel, also documented as Frederick Charles Merkel and nicknamed Bonehead. American first baseman in Major League Baseball from 1907 to 1926. And that was his very first year. He was still a teenager on September 23rd of 1908 when he made that play, and he was known as Bonehead for the rest of his life. Oh, poor guy. Bobby Witt Jr. is not going to be the same. Keeper Ryan A's not going to be the same for either of you guys. You'll be fine.
No, but like 1907 to 1926, like that's a good
life. In your career. And his very first season, his rookie year. Oh, that poor guy. What a bummer. What a bummer for old Bonehead. All right. Well, we'll get set to wrap this one up as we say goodbye from Three Stakes. We'll wrap it up next.
Interrupt this podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Back to Ghosts of the Miners, in which all of you out there in Radioland must identify the legitimate historical ball club hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One belongs to the realm of memory, the others to fantasy. In last week's segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball teams did at one time exist. A. The Melbourne Citrus Squeezers. B. The Amsterdam Rugmakers. C. The Moscow Millers. Every fiber of my being knows they rolled out the red carpet for the rug makers in old Amsterdam, New York, a once industrial burg just a stitch outside Schenectady. Catcher manager Admiral Martin was at the helm when Amsterdam took first place in its debut Canadian American League season of 1938, but the Admiral's club was sunk in the playoffs. The rug makers finished first again the next year, but once more came undone in the postseason. In 1940, though, led by slugging third sacker Paul Badgett and outfielder-slash-skipper Eddie Sawyer, the Yankees-affiliated rugmakers pulled the whatchamacallit out from under the competition in the playoffs for their first and only title. That's okay, the rugmakers really tied the league together for 8 more seasons.
Hey, careful, man, there's a beverage here, huh?
Amsterdam began the magic carpet ride careers of Vic Rashi and Lou Burdett, one-time rugmakers who combined to weave together 335 wins in the major leagues. But on Halloween 1951, the Sporting News reported that the Yankees had lost $60,000 vacuuming up expenses for the rugmakers over the previous 2 years. The financiers were floored by the figures, and the final thread was pulled from the rugmakers. And that about covers it for the Amsterdam Rugmakers, who spent more time on the ceiling than underfoot in the Can-Am League. So now, let's dip into the waters of next week's question.
Giddy up!
Which of these aquatic-oriented clubs sank or swam in the minors? A. The Woods Hole Deep Divers. B. The Miramar Beach Beachies. C. The Green Bay Bays. Hope floats, and you're sure to get the answer if you tune into next week's edition of Ghosts of the Miners. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer Ben Hill has insulted Clifford Odets, and he's getting red in the face.
Fire! final segment of this week's episode of the show before the show. MILB.TV is your place for all the best and brightest in minor league baseball. Sam, what are you watching on MILB TV this week?
I mean, I'm going to go the obvious route, which is to say Northwest Arkansas is playing Frisco. That Bobby Witt Jr. game was obviously the first game of a six-game series, so things are going to get real interesting down there if everybody's going to be watching everybody touch every base going forward. But you're going to want to watch Bobby Witt Jr. because he could have another two-homer game. It's certainly possible. But also Nick Prado on that Royals team. Didn't bring him up during the pop-up prospect section. Certainly could have. I know coming into the season, covering the Royals a little bit, they were really high on some of the changes he made last year, you know, coming off the outside and instructs and all that. With the way he was starting to elevate the ball more, make a few adjustments, especially when it came to his approach. And we're seeing that come through right now. Witt and Prado, and I'll even throw in MJ Melendez. Those three guys are as good as prospects as you're going to find on a double-A team. They're all grouped together. So seeing those guys tee off against Frisco should certainly be exciting. But, yeah, you're mostly going to want to tune in to just any homer in that series. Everybody's going to be forensically looking at how they touch the bases. So you're going to want to tune in for that drama. Tyler, what do you got your eye on?
I'm going to Richmond, Virginia. I'm not literally going to Richmond, Virginia, but for my MILB TV pick, I'm going to Richmond, Virginia, where the Flying Squirrels will be home to take on the Harrisburg Senators. Tonight, we're recording this on Wednesday, so unfortunately you'll hear it after this, but tonight their promo is salute to dogs with jobs. But it's, oh, you know, it's like service dogs. I thought it was like, oh, this dog works at the local car wash, and I thought that'd be super cool. But it's not. But the reason I am picking the Richmond Flying Squirrels is because third-ranked San Francisco Giants prospect Elliot Ramos has been really good for them, especially of late. 288, 373, 441 is slash line in 29 games with AA Richmond. Elliot Ramos feels like we've been talking about him forever. He's still just 21 years old. Really, really good young prospect in that system. Richmond will be home to take on Harrisburg for the rest of the week. If you watch the Friday game, Richmond will be dressed up in their Copa identity, our Diaz Voladores, the Flying Squirrels. And then coming up on Saturday, that's Friday. Did I say Saturday? Friday is Copa. Saturday is 50s and 60s throwback night with a fullback jersey auction. And now I'm just really excited to see what the fullback jersey looks like.
I was going to say, have you seen those? I really actually like the hats.
Okay. Well, now I have to go
look. The hats are really nice. They look, to describe them for all of you listening to this audio podcast, it's an R, but like in the R is the state of Virginia.
It's the state of Virginia.
Yeah. Which if I had closer Richmond ties, my cousin once lived there, so that's as close as I'm going to get. And I visited, and it's a very pleasant city.
Oh, I very much like this.
Yeah, but it's a great fullback hat, I got to say.
It is. Yeah, this is great. I know they've used that logo before, but having it on that clean red hat with this jersey, I'm digging it. So that's what's coming up this weekend in Richmond. You can check out Elliot Ramos and the rest of the Flying Squirrels and the Harrisburg Senators on MILB.TV. So that'll do it for this week's episode of the show before the show. You can get in touch, podcast@MILB.com. You can find us on Twitter. Sam is at Sam Dykstra MILB. Benjamin Hill is at Ben's Biz, and I am at Tyler Mon. And for Sam and Ben, I'm Tyler. We'll talk to you next week.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. You guys know I'm always up for a good MVP story, and one of the best stories is Wasabi Technology. Wasabi is the world's hottest cloud storage company, and it's become the go-to provider for professional and collegiate sports teams, including 20 Major League Baseball teams like the Red Sox and NHL teams like the Bruins and Vancouver Canucks. Even the Liverpool Football Club is getting in on the Wasabi action. So why is Wasabi the MVP? Well, Wasabi was purpose-built to free businesses from skyrocketing storage costs and unpredictable transaction fees that the Amazon of the world are charging. In fact, Wasabi is up to 80% less than those hyperscalers and doesn't charge a cent for businesses to access their data. From Wasabi's AI-enabled intelligent media storage, Wasabi Air, to the industry's only cloud storage service with triple protection against cyber criminals, data deletion, and ransomware, Wasabi's taking the lead in driving innovation in data storage and helping sports teams to unleash the power of their data. Wasabi, another Boston-based championship team.